Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Welcome to Everybody in the Pool, the podcast for the climate economy. We dive deep into the climate crisis and come up with solutions. I'm Molly Wood. This week, I'm excited to talk to one of the success stories from what is sometimes called Clean Tech 1.0 in the climate tech and investing world. This is a period between 2006 and 2011 when about $25 billion worth of venture capital was invested in clean energy startups. It was a bit of a bubble, followed by what some people consider a bust, but several of those companies are still around and have made back those billions many, many times over. Think Tesla, Sunrun, who was on the show, Beyond Meat, and my guest today, Enphase Energy, a now public company that created all new microinverter technology for controlling and optimizing rooftop solar panels. Now, Enphase is innovating in battery technology and smart home energy systems to put affordable, renewable, and resilient power everywhere possible in my favorite way, decentralized.
My name is Raghu Belur. I'm the Chief Product Officer and co-founder of Enphase. Enphase is a global energy technology company. We are a renewable energy technology company with a focus in solar and batteries and EV chargers, et cetera, in order to deliver kind of a very sophisticated home energy management system for the home.
Give me a little bit of the background, if you wouldn't mind, of the company. How was it developed and what was the kind of central thesis?
Yeah, that's a great question. As all entrepreneurs, particularly here in Silicon Valley, you know, you're always looking at a problem and thinking, hey, you know, I can do this better. Right? I can do it differently, or there's a better way to do it. And so we had Martin and I, who is the other co-founder of the company, the two of us had come out of having worked at a couple of different startups where we had started begin to notice how technology evolves, where in the long run, everything moves to a decentralized or a distributed architecture. What that means in network parlance, because networking is where we came out of, is that the endpoints of the network become more intelligent and they start making autonomous decisions. Contrast that to what a centralized topology would be, where the endpoints would be pretty dumb and all knowledge is centralized and all decision-making is done in a centralized manner. Mm-hmm. That's not how the world evolves, the technology world evolves. If you look at mainframe computers to PCs, if you look at data centers, if you look at your smartphone, et cetera, these endpoints are becoming extremely intelligent. There's a common thread that runs through, particularly these examples that I've given you, the common thread being it's about digital and software. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of the foundation that we came off of, that the world moves in that direction. For me, this was my fifth startup, meaning, you know, three of them that I had worked at, one that Martin and I had started before. For Martin, I think Enphase was his sixth startup. So our whole career had been startups.
Yep.
It's kind of how we'd been trained. When we started looking at energy, and in particular, we started looking at solar, we realized that it was ready for disruption because it was being done in a centralized manner. Solar itself, particularly both residential, commercial, utility scale solar, was done in a centralized manner, meaning power conversion was being done through a big box inverter. Mm-hmm. So you feed the output of all the solar panels, you aggregate them all up and you feed it into one box. And that box takes the output of the solar panel and converts it into AC that's usable in your home. And our view was, if our thesis holds true that long in the long term, everything moves to a decentralized or a distributed architecture, and it does so because of cost, performance, and reliability reasons, this needs to be disrupted. We need to move from centralized power conversion to fully distributed power conversion, distributed energy generation, which is through microinverters. Mm-hmm. And of course, we had to invent the microinverter quite candidly, using digital technology by building our own custom ASIC and leveraging a lot of software. And that we realized would be this recipe for success if we can effectively do that. But we had to come up with some really major technological breakthrough in order to achieve that. Because what you're trying to do is build something that's going to go up on the roof, very harsh environment, mm-hmm. and it has to last for 25 years. How do I make a piece of power electronics that can last on the roof for 25 years?
So I'm going to ask you for some definitions for people who aren't too familiar with this. But first, just at a foundational level, I want to sort of put a fine point on the fact that you set out not to disrupt just the energy industry, but disrupt the renewable energy industry as it had already sprung up.
Yeah. And at the time, yeah, because our view was in the, you know, looking, if you take a step back and look at the way the energy business is evolving in this world,
yeah.
It has to become renewable.
Like that was already pretty messed up. Right.
It's exactly right. We'd already done a pretty horrible job of screwing up our planet. So, so we needed to, you know, we knew that it has got to evolve. So no longer, I remember it used to be called as alternate energy.
Yeah.
It's not alternate energy anymore. It's renewable as mainstream energy, right? So we started looking at it saying, okay, within the energy infrastructure, what is it that we can influence, right? We are not going to go into the centralized generation business. We are not going to go into any fancy fossil fuel based. We are not going to reinvent fossil fuel generation technologies. We were really focused on what was cutting edge. Mm-hmm. And even there was a nuance. A lot of people at the time when we started were looking at improving the solar panel technology.
Right.
Nobody was paying attention to the inverter. And they were assuming, oh, well, inverters have been around for 40 years and what's there to disrupt? And that was perfect for us in that, no, there is. If you think about it differently, if you think out of the box, it's actually ripe for disruption. Hmm. So not only did we come up with this new way of doing power inversion using a microinverter, but we also actually built a full system out of it.
Right.
So we embedded...
Wait. Before you tell me about the full system, you have to go all the way back and tell people what the inverter does and what it was not doing well so that you had to invent the microinverter. We're going to basics here for folks.
You got it. So, an inverter is a device that takes the output of your solar panel and converts it into energy that's usable by your home, by your appliances in your home, by your microwave, by your lights, by your TVs. Because the output that the solar panel produces is not usable. It's called DC, or direct current. We needed alternate current, or alternating current, which is AC. So the inverter takes DC and converts it into AC to make it usable in your home. And that conversion process was being done by a big box device, centralized device, a big box inverter. Mm-hmm. We said, no, we need to disrupt that. We're going to do it decentralized or distributed. We are going to take all this big box inverter and turn them into little microinverters and put each one behind every single panel.
Right.
So what that does is then every single panel and in microinverter pair acts like independent energy producer.
And so it's more efficient. It harvests more of the actual solar energy.
More energy. Exactly. So if you look at the challenges of a centralized architecture as it pertains to solar is the output of one solar panel dictates the output of the other because they're all connected in series. It's like a Christmas light problem.
Right. Oh, the one bulb. No.
Yeah, one bulb, exactly. And then you're searching around for it because there is no information to go figure out where the problem is. So that's the fundamental problem. There's your centralized topology problem, right?
Yep.
So because of the series connection, the output of one dictates the output of the other. That's the first problem. The second problem is that big box inverter is processing a lot of power and it's prone to failures. And when it does fail, it takes your entire system down because there's only that one thing that's doing all the processing. There's only one inverter. There's no redundancy.
Yeah.
Right? The third problem is because you're aggregating all the panels by connecting them all up in series, you have to manage what's called very high voltage DC. And high voltage DC is esoteric, so it's difficult to install, it's difficult to manage. And the last problem is high voltage DC can create arc faults and potentially start fires. So there's a safety element as well. So when we came up with this notion of a decentralized or a distributed architecture where we were taking a small microinverter and sticking it on the back of every single panel, what we effectively did was connect the entire plant in parallel.
Right.
Now, each and every panel and inverter acts like an independent energy producer. And so the output of one is not dictated by the output of the other. So your Christmas light problem disappears. So now I can make sure that every single microinverter is optimizing or maximizing the output of its associated panel. Your entire plant is in parallel. So one is you yield more. The second thing is that the unit, because it's processing so little power, you know, a big box inverter is processing 5,000 watts or 7,000 watts of power. A microinverter could be processing about 300 watts. Mm-hmm. But you have many of them, right? That means you can make the device. It's not a power device. It's a power electronics device. And if you build it using digital topology, build your own custom chip, rely on software, you can make that device extremely reliable.
Yeah.
So one, the device doesn't fail. And second, there is no single point of failure. Meaning if one inverter, microinverter were to fail, if you have a home with a typical home has 20 solar panels and 20 microinverters, if you lose one, 95% of your system is still up and going.
Yep.
Right? So we address the yield problem, we address the reliability problem. The third thing is the output of the of that microinverter is AC, alternating current. It's what's used in your home directly. So it becomes a very plug-and-play device. So it was very simple to design, very simple to install, and it was very simple to maintain because I pushed the intelligence deeper into the network, my original comment about distributed architecture. Now the panel is extremely intelligent because of this intelligence that's in the inverter. Now I can track precisely what's going on every single panel, how it's performing. Is it doing the best it can? Mm-hmm. The last element is fire safety. I'm not accumulating or summing up all the high voltage. I'm converting low voltage that each panel puts out straight into one shot into AC.
Yeah.
So arguably much safer. So that was the genesis of the thinking. What we did add some more stuff to it. We said, we are going to make it into an IoT device. And this is before the word IoT was even popular.
Yeah.
We didn't even know it was just natural for us to do that is we embedded full bidirectional communications technology into every single microinverter. So not only was it a lot of software running in every single device, it also was communicating bidirectionally to a gateway, and the gateway was connected to a cloud. So we had a full communications link between the cloud and every single device.
Yeah.
And so we knew in real time exactly how every single solar panel's doing, how every single device in your system is performing. And leveraging the power of IoT, if you wanted to fix something, in most cases, we could just push a software upgrade, just like you do software upgrades on your phone. We were doing exactly the same thing. We can still do exactly the same thing. We just push software upgrades onto this device. So the link is fully bidirectional. That each and every device tells us how it's doing, and we can tell the device to change its behavior if needed. That was powerful. Again, this really comes back to thinking about and not losing sight of the big picture. Mm-hmm. The big picture here was it was about the entire energy infrastructure.
Yeah.
And when you look at today's energy infrastructure, I joke about this, and I've used this joke before. I say if Thomas Edison or Nikola Tesla or Westinghouse were walking down the streets of Oakland, California, or Fremont, California, and they looked up at the energy infrastructure, the poles, the wires, the substations, the transformers, they would recognize all elements of it. Mm. This infrastructure hasn't changed in 125 years.
Yeah.
It used to be the marvel of the 20th century, but things are not the same anymore, right? And so our view, the big picture, which we really didn't never wanted to lose sight of, was how do you disrupt the entire energy infrastructure? And that notion of decentralizing a system that's within the home is actually applicable to the entire energy infrastructure. How do I decentralize the entire energy infrastructure? Mm-hmm. Which is, instead of having a big central gas power plant or a oil-fired plant or a coal-powered plant and transmission lines and distribution, substation and distribution and all the infrastructure to come to your house, can I rethink that, turn it over on its head and say the unit of intelligence is the home? Push intelligence into the home, where the home can do many things, including generation and storage and intelligently consume energy. Mm-hmm. And also help the grid out if needed. This was the notion of reinventing the grid from the inside out. That was our big picture vision.
Yeah.
And that vision is still true today. And here's an interesting observation. We never named the company Enphase Solar. We are always Enphase Energy because our view was we wanted to disrupt the energy market.
Right. So if it becomes geothermal or backpack nuclear, it could be anything.
It could be anything. Today, yeah, we know of a few things. So today the market is evolving. The reason why battery evolution comes as a result of change in the marketplace, it comes because people are starting to electrify. They're starting to recognize that, hey, I want to have a very, very small, if any, carbon footprint. So they're saying, I want to get off of gas as well. I want to electrify my whole life. Electrification within the home means electrifying your heating and cooling, right? Going to heat pumps, electrifying your transportation, which means going to electric vehicles, electrifying your hot water heaters, right?
Yep.
But how do I service the needs of the home when my home is trying to electrify?
Right.
Because your demand per home when you electrify is going to more than double. Here's a simple math. An average consumption in the U.S. per home is about 30 kilowatt hours per day. An EV is going to consume about 15 kilowatt hours per day. That's a typical commute, 40-mile commute. Mm-hmm. Two EVs, there I am, an additional 30 kilowatt hours per day. Add a heat pump for heating your home, it's going to be another 15 kilowatt hours a day. So now I've more than doubled my consumption.
Yep.
How do I meet this doubling of demand? I read somewhere that by 2035, I think the average consumption in California is going to go up by more than 40%. I read that somewhere. Mm. Mm-hmm. That's a massive increase in consumption, electric consumption. And my view is that there is no way the existing infrastructure by itself is capable of delivering that much energy to the home.
Yeah. I feel like it's important for us to be specific about that part of it, that this is about resiliency and reliability and safety, but also about our ability to actually accomplish the energy transition.
Exactly right. So with the resiliency and all of those are actually table stakes.
Yep.
You must be resilient, right?
They should be
resilient. And unfortunately, you know, even that can be done, that can be made better. So I have to deliver now more than 2x the amount of energy I used to consume before.
Yep.
And the infrastructure has to support that much more delivery of that much more energy. And I would argue that no way.
Yeah.
No way can it do it on its own. You must do it if you think about it on a first principles basis, you have to be your own generation resource. You need to be able to generate your own energy. You need to be able to store it. You need to be able to use it very intelligently. And the final part is, because now you are this unit of intelligence that's capable of producing its own energy, saving its own energy, using it intelligently, it can also help out others who may need the energy when you have a surplus. That future is here today.
Time for a quick break. When we come back, more on the future of decentralized energy, and we're going to get a little ranty on some policy mistakes from what has been the country's biggest market for rooftop solar.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome back to Everybody in the Pool. Let's rejoin my conversation with Raghu Belur of Enphase Energy about decentralizing the grid. In this back half, we're going to talk about how to put the right policies in place to make sure we're adopting renewable energy at the rate we need to meet our emissions reduction goals, and not screwing it up by taking incentives off the table too soon. California. What does the policy landscape look like? And I guess, simply put, what would you like to see?
Yeah, you know, policy drives markets. We are in a highly regulated market. Energy is a highly regulated market, and policy makes and breaks markets. Mm-hmm. Look at the California Solar Initiative that started in 2007. Was, I would argue, kind of the genesis of the phenomenal growth that California has had in renewables. It is a leadership position in renewables. Mm-hmm. And it has been a phenomenal, phenomenal example of success. And then you take contrast that with what happened with the new policy change with regards to any net billing tariff or what's called as NEM 3.0. Mm-hmm.
Which we should explain a little bit. It effectively just slashed the amount. Explain it to us that you get for it.
Sure. Historically, California and the U.S. in general has been what's called a net metered market or a net energy metering. Mm-hmm. What net energy metering means, in the middle of the day, because I have excess solar generation, I'm not necessarily at home and I have all the solar production, which peaks in the middle of the day, I can export it into the grid. And in the evening, when I come back home, or at night when there is no solar, I can buy back that energy that I banked into the grid in the middle of the day. And there was a one-to-one relationship. What I sold into the grid in the middle of the day, I bought back from the grid.
Yep.
And there was a true-up or a netting that took place at the end of the year. The new policy says that if you export in the middle of the day, you'll get 1/10 of what you were getting paid before, or even less.
Yeah.
So the new policy says that if you export any electron into the grid into the middle of the day, you know, you really effectively won't get compensated at all. You're giving those electrons away for free, effectively. Mm-hmm. What that means is you really need a battery. So that in the middle of the day, when I have all this excess solar production, I can store all that energy into my battery and then use it when I don't have it. When my solar is not producing anything late evening, of course, in the middle of the night. That sounds great. Just add a battery. But the reality is the battery technology is still in its infancy. Mm-hmm. It's evolving. Infancy in terms of performance, in terms of cost, in terms of safety. We have a long ways to go. And I think they got it wrong, quite frankly.
Yeah.
The change that they made, the Public Utilities Commission made, was way too abrupt. We really said, hey, there should be a nice glide path into it. We recognize that it needs to happen in the long run. This change must happen in the long run, right? We agree, but don't do it so abruptly. And look what they've done.
Yeah.
I think California Solar and Storage Association put out a number like 17,000 jobs lost.
Mm-hmm. And installation rates. Well, and worst of all, solar installation rates have plummeted.
Plummeted.
So if your goal is energy transition, don't get me started on this one. I could give you like an hour of rage on this one.
It's really frustrating that they did it. I understand, like I said, again, I'm in support of it in the long run. Mm-hmm. It makes sense. but there should have been a transition. There should have been a glide path. Mm-hmm. If you look at what's happening in other countries, in the Netherlands, for example, in the Netherlands, penetration level of solar is at 27%. And there was a lot of discussion about how do you make this transition away from net metering. And there was a vote about 2 weeks ago, and there was going to be a glide path, a pretty well thought out 5-year plan to glide path it. But the government said, no, I don't think you guys are ready even for that. Mm. The government pretty much said, no, we're going to keep net metering for now, and let's revisit it in another couple of years. And I think what we have to demonstrate in the next 2 years is the industry has to demonstrate that, yeah, as you step down net metering, the transition will be pretty smooth. Because, look, at the end of the day, the fact is we need to transition this energy infrastructure.
Right.
We don't have a choice. We have a 2050 mandate of 1.5 degrees C, and we need to make that transition.
Yeah.
And these kind of policy decisions have been really detrimental to that change. So I think there's a lot to be learned. There's a lot to be learned from looking at all the markets around the world. And it's interesting that how different markets react differently and act differently. But that's part of the course as it pertains to policy.
Right. Why do we, just out of curiosity, why you say long-term the change has to happen, that we have to transition off of net metering? Why is that?
Again, I think, like I said, we need to be a market participant. Mm-hmm. And the argument that the utilities make is, hey, you're using my grid as a free battery, mm-hmm. right? When you do net metering, which is in the middle of the day, you export energy into it. Yeah, but there is tremendous amount of locational value for having localized generation, because as my demand in the home goes up, it's my solar that's feeding my demand. The infrastructure simply cannot support the 2.5x of demand increase that's coming. So you need my local generation. So you have tremendous amount of locational value. I don't have all the losses, transmission, distribution losses that I have to deal with. Mm-hmm. And if you're going to do is upgrade your entire infrastructure, it's going to cost tens, if not hundreds of billions of dollars. And in a volumetric pricing world, that means everybody's rates go up. That's not helpful either.
Right.
So the balance is, hey, localized generation, localized storage, localized usage with contribution to the network. Mm-hmm. And so I think that is the evolution and that's the argument, right? And this whole notion of, it's really frustrating, this whole notion of cost shift, et cetera, that was proposed as a reason for moving to net billing tariff or NEM 3.0. Well, when your solar installations have plummeted, you would naturally expect that the utility rates would go down then, if that was your argument. Here we are going into our second rate hike. Mm-hmm. Come on.
Yeah. I mean, I feel like, you know, California is such a beacon in so many ways. And we have been a beacon on the one end of how to do it right. And now, I agree with you that currently we're an example of sort of how to do it wrong.
They got it wrong. And I hope they do something to fix it, because it can be fixed. And I hope they do something to fix it, because we are all in this together. Mm-hmm. We are all in this together. The utilities have a major role to play. Distributed generation has a major role to play. And we just need to learn to coexist.
Mm-hmm. How does this compare to how other states that may be, I mean, California, I assume, is the biggest market for solar in the U.S.
Well, I don't think it's anymore.
Oh, right. I'm sorry. Happened. Good point. Maybe 2 years ago it was.
Yeah, it's unfortunate. California was the leader in solar, really showed the way for the rest of the country. And unfortunately, it's not the case anymore. And so I think other states most other states actually already have net metering. Continue to have net metering. Some states are looking at different tariff structures, which is fine. For example, in some states, there is something called demand charge in residential, which is, hey, I will charge you based on how much power you're using at certain times of the day. Time of use is actually an interesting proposition, right? We're not arguing against time of use. Those are all important transitions that need to take place. But to have something as abrupt as net billing tariff that, you know, the numbers are obvious that it devastated the market, mm-hmm. is not the right approach. But there are transitions that we need to learn to make.
Yeah. And then finally, in our last few minutes, let's talk a little bit about the role of the battery. I mean, obviously, it's becoming, I think, more and more clear, but it also seems like the role of the battery is even broader than we initially thought. So talk about the role of the battery going forward.
Exactly. Just a few years ago, people were thinking about battery was all about resilience.
Yeah.
Hey, when the grid fails and the grid has been failing a lot, people are like, oh, I can switch to my battery and power my home, isolate my home from the grid, build a microgrid basically, and power my home from the battery. But the role of the battery has evolved. One of the challenges with solar is it is an intermittent resource. Mm-hmm. I don't have solar at night. I don't have solar when it's very cloudy. But if I can have a battery, stationary battery, that I can then charge when there is an abundance of solar and then utilize it when my solar production diminishes, that really makes the solar system really powerful. Mm-hmm. The combination of solar and batteries become very powerful. Then I can do things like what was the intention of the net billing tariff for NEM 3.0, which is, hey, don't export any electron in the middle of the day because you're going to get paid nothing for it. Instead, take all that excess electrons that you have and store it in your stationary battery.
Yeah.
Or store it in your car.
Right.
Or store it thermally in your electric hot water heater. So there are many things. So the battery's role has evolved from not only providing resiliency, but also providing this, what you could call it, arbitrage, mm-hmm. which means I store free electrons into my battery from my solar system, and then use it when I don't have enough solar production, or use it when the rates are extremely high, like during summer peak rates of time of use between 4 p.m. and 9 p.m. Don't buy from the grid because the demand on the grid is very high, mm-hmm. one, and the rates are extremely high. Instead, use your own electrons that you stored in the middle of the day.
Yeah.
So the role of the battery is definitely evolving. And the other role of the battery also is this notion of participation in helping the grid up. Because when the signal comes from the network that says, hey, help me out, I need a little bit more supply, your solar may not be there to help you out. Instead, if I've stored all my excess electrons in the battery, I can discharge my battery and say, here I am helping out the grid. Mm-hmm. And of course, get paid for it. Mm-hmm. So the role of battery has evolved significantly.
And then I want to ask you about because you are also digitizing and building software, I want to ask you about the sort of software controls for, let's say, this battery management, this power management. Because, I have now been at parties where it is primarily men. I literally was at a party the other day where all of these men at one end of the table were showing each other their usage stats, right?
Yep.
I don't want to geek out about my energy to that extent. Yep. I just want my battery to handle it for me.
Yeah, exactly right. I always think about it. If you were to again step back and go, look, what do you want from your energy system? You want to walk up to a light switch, flip the light switch on, and the lights always come on. It's the most economical form of energy. I don't want to pay too much for it. It's the cleanest and it's the safest. Mm-hmm. Those are the four things I really care about. So to that end, from a software point of view, the software is becoming extremely sophisticated. If you think about it, I have many disparate resources in the home. I have solar, I have batteries, I have EVs, EV charging, EVs bidirectionally. I have heat pumps, and I have the grid. And the grid has really complex tariffs now, whether that is demand charge or NEM. So I need now a very sophisticated optimization software that's looking at all of these things in an economical basis and deciding what source of electrons to use. Should I discharge my battery? Should I buy from the grid? Should I sell from the grid? Should I charge my battery? Should I charge my car? Should I discharge my car? All of that optimization has to be done through software. Mm-hmm. And we obviously provide you with all of that information on your phone, but you don't have to use it.
Right.
My view is that
I don't want to know.
Sophisticated software that's doing the right thing for you. If you want to geek out, you're welcome to. If you don't want to geek out on it, perfectly okay. The light must always come on. Should be the cleanest form of energy, the most economical form of energy, and of course, the safest form of energy.
Amazing. Raghu Belur, thank you so much for the time. This is fascinating. I could do this all day.
Awesome. Thank you, Molly. Great questions. Enjoyed being on your show.
Thanks. So there's no question, we have to get there.
The future of energy is distributed, with solar, batteries, EVs, and smart software optimizing it all at the home level while staying connected to the grid. How we get there is still sort of two steps forward, one step back. The policy and the market structures are crucial too. My opinion, prioritize adoption as fast as possible, as cheaply as possible, for as many people as possible, even if that means subsidizing the crap out of things. I mean, we do it with fossil fuels all the time. More on that topic in the newsletter this week, which you can subscribe to over at everybodyinthepool.com. And that's it for this episode. Thanks for taking the time to listen. Please rate and review the show if you haven't already. And if you want to become a subscriber and get an ad-free version of the show, hit the link in the description in your podcast app of choice. See you next week.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.